Number two lesson this fall, which is actually extension of last spring. So I'm counting now, this is 30 lessons in that series. So called Zionism, planning the reoccupation of the land. I said something wrong last week that if you want to get the lessons, you don't go to the Sound Words website. That's the bookstore. You go to the church website. Or then you go to church website, then you go to classes, and then my class courses issues, and there are the newest ones on top, so they're not hard to find. On your mobile app, which is, for you guys know what that is, they're these guys, mobile apps. There you go to Sound Words, Sound Words app. And there you have the issues lesson, but not my Sunday school class. But anyway, I just want to correct that. Disagreement on Zionism. I guess that's an understatement, and it's worldwide. I thought I'd put a bunch of flags. I don't know that I see Israel's flag in there. Probably is in there somewhere. The flags of around the UN. Last week, we talked about the three views of the earth and the land. And why is the question of the land, why is the question who occupies the land such an issue in the world, which has been going on now for centuries, even millenniums, probably back to the conquest of the land, 1500 BC, something like that, 1400. You can almost imagine some people in a particular country might have interest in their neighboring nations, but as it is, the whole world is divided along the lines of who should be in the land. Of course, we're talking about the land of Israel. Now, we divided up this worldview. Last week, we talked about the humanists. The humanists ought to have a laissez-faire attitude about who's in the land. What difference does it make to them? In keeping with the progress of humanity, the Jews are way ahead of most of the human race in proportion to scientists and economics and producers, creative people. So they really should be preferred in the humanist system because they would be a great economic benefit to any nation. But that's not the case. And the covenantalists, the Christian friends, sort of, I guess some of them are, certainly, ought to read their Bibles as God spoke it. Then they would find that the land belonged to the Jews. But humanism has crept into perversely corrupted Christianity. So this falsification puts the Jews out as God's chosen people. Now they are just simply God's rejected people, and we don't read our Bibles that way at all. Now, it's probably an overstatement to say that wherever there's trouble or controversy, God is at work. I still think that's probably true. However, we can say that wherever God is at work, there is controversy, and so we find that with the land. God's choice of a piece of land that God calls mine, kind of a little selfish here, is at the center of the earth. This is the center, a special place elevated above his general ownership. So all of it is mine, he says, but this is mine, mine. Psalm 24:1 talks about the general ownership. But when he talks to Israel and he gives them the land, he says, the land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. Talking to Israel, whose land it is. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Leviticus 25:23, Exodus 19:5, he says, so then if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possessions. Talking about that generation. Among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. So we have this ownership statement that's quite clear. Now, if the answer to the question of ownership would be settled, then what does who owns it? We say, well, God owns it. And then the question of who occupies the land would immediately be settled, because God has said, and if we think God owns it, then that settles it. So who does own the earth? It is apparent that the battle goes on at this level. Who owns the earth? The humanists argue that the earth is Gaia's, the Greek goddess of the earth. We call her, some of us still do, are in the habit of calling her Mother Nature. We're going to quit that, aren't we? If Gaia owns the earth, yet Gaia, here's the interesting thing about Gaia, who owns the earth, yet Gaia has not spoken one word, then it must be up to those who worship Gaia to speak for her. She can't speak, so somebody must speak for her. Since a message cannot be confirmed or falsified, we don't know whether it's true or it's not, or if it is true, she is given voice by those who yield the greatest power. Guy that has the biggest stick or whatever. And these days, that power resides in the state, the government. If the state does not acknowledge God's ownership, the state decides the ownership, or the states together decide the ownership. And I might ask, and once in a while in the echoes of our legislature, you might hear the word God occasionally, but I still ask the question, whoever in the state appeals to the word of God for anything, except in a very general sense. But we do want God to bless America. That's how everybody says that. Now, since God has spoken, what he has said can be verified or falsified. How? Well, this authority rests in the consistent consistent objective observation. In other words, we all see the thing, see the same thing. I know there are things different, but there are certain things that are just true. And we all can agree to that. You're all sitting in chairs tonight. We'll agree to that. Yeah, I mean, that's something that's just obviously true. You know, everything else, and the sky is blue and sky is up, and you know, everything about the world, the trees are apparently made, they didn't just happen by accident. So we have people that are reasonable, look at the world, and come to the same conclusion, like somebody made it. So authority resides in the consistent objective observation of creation. And the fulfilled prophecies, verbal prophecies, those things that God has said have been fulfilled. Together, they authorize his written word. What he has said is consistent with what we observe. So the world is obviously and purposefully created together with fulfilled prophecy, form a self-consistent authority without circular reasoning. As always, the word says this about itself, but we look outside the word to see it's verified, and we look at the reality as it is. So it verifies the word, even though the word is self-consistent. But even outside the word, it can be made consistent. So we'd have all that authority when we say who owns the land. Last week, we mentioned the Abrahamic covenant. Just in passing, we'll mention it again. It is the basis for the Jewish land ownership. And I put ownership under quotation marks because for years I've always said ownership, but it probably is a custodialship. Because we just got through saying God said the land is mine, right? So God never gives up the ownership. So what does Israel get? They actually get a custodialship. They get to use it. Maybe we call it a land lease. All right, so I put ownership in that quotation. We will not repeat the Abrahamic covenant except to remind us that God has spoken about the land, and that should settle a question for us. And there still are questions occasionally from Christians who don't know for sure who the land belongs to, and those are our covenantal friends or those that are still fuzzy about this question. So we assume true what God has said about the land and the people chosen to live in the land. Now, if we have the question, who are they? In our terminology, they are the Jews of our day. Now, who is a Jew? We have a working definition, at least one for us, is identifiable family of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And you might argue about others. We can, too, but that's not part of our study. But at least we can say these are Jews. There may be some more that are outside this, you know, proselyte people, so forth. Do they become part of the inheritance? Question mark. Leave that alone. Now, that one verse we have in Amos 3:2 talks about, you only have I chosen, among all the families have on the earth have I chosen, says. And so there's another example of that chosenness. So God chooses the people, he chooses the land, and they puts them in the same place. Now, from the time of Abraham, there has been a division in the families of the earth into the Jew and Gentile. That's the two groups. Both are defined as not being of the other. You can't be half Jew and half Gentile. I mean, you're just one or the other. According to the way God looks at it, we may be confused. But you're either Jew or a Gentile. Besides, don't worry about the proselyte Jew. A conflict between the Gentile and the Jew has continued in all history, at least all history back to the day of Abraham. The Christian era, 325, let's say, maybe a little earlier, 312 perhaps, when Constantine took over the Roman Empire, turned it into a Christian empire by fiat. That's not a car. The Christian era, about, let's say, 325, ought to have brought an improvement in the Gentile-Jew relationship. But because of the arrogance of the Gentile, and not the Jew here, the Jews were persecuted by the Christians. The church was warned about this. Paul warned them about that in Romans 11:20. Says, Gentiles, do not be seated or conceited, but fear. He's talking to the church, Gentile church, which has Jews in it. In the early church centuries, Jews had a long standing as a recognized people. Thus, they had a status in the Roman Empire. Christians outside of Judaism did not. So Christianity became the new group that came in. Therefore, the empire persecuted the Christians and not so much the Jews. Now, they did persecute the Jews. They threw them out. But the Christians were the ones most persecuted. However, Christians, this is where the mistake is, wanting to cut off the Jews, did not want the Jews to continue, especially after 312, and they began a Christian on Jew persecution in direct violation of Romans 9 and 11, a condition Paul anticipated and condemned. Now, of course, this animosity ran both ways in the early centuries, to be sure, but Jews do not kill Christians. It's the Christians that kill the Jews. Sorry. So we start our lesson here, and I remind you that we have a lot of lessons behind us that we're not going to go through. They fit here, and they cover the period. Go back to pick this up from the Reformation. It'd be a good place to pick it up a little bit before, perhaps, when the English Bible was available to people in England. So therefore, beginning in the 14th century, the British Christians read the prophecies concerning the restoration of the Jews. They began to talk of a Jewish restoration to the land. Christians went through the ideas of historicism, confused at this point, thinking that the Bible was being fulfilled in their very eyes and their presence, which led them to believe that the Lord was going to come after the world was made ready for his return, which is called postmillennialism, was pretty well became not very popular, as premillennialism is what we are, became more and more prominent, starting with Darby, and that would be about 1830, and so on even till today. Fundamentalists generally are premillennial, dispensational, believe in a premillennial return of Christ, a pre-tribulational return of Christ. So I just did a little outline, which I do a lot of times for myself. I'll just put it up. It's kind of what are things that are behind us. We have, first of all, the diaspora from 70 AD to 1580, and the diaspora continues, but we stop there with today's lesson, pick up around 1850 and move forward. I hope to get further than I will. I wanted to get through, clear up to 1921, but I'm not going to get that far. So we're going to do 1850 probably to about 1900, maybe a little after that, which will include the Russian pogroms set up Zionism with its results. And then we have the first Zionist conference. We'll do that today, but we'll not do the Bauflower after the World War I. And so on, we get to Hitler and those things that leads us to the Independence Day for Israel, 1948. So we have this kind of a chart of history. We have the Jews in the beginning had status, the pink part during the cross, and the church had no status. And when Constantine made Christianity the state religion, it flipped over. Christians became prominent, and the Jews were out of favor. And that lasted that way until, as we said, the Bible in English was being read in Britain, and then slowly restoration ideas began. And by the time you get to 1850, which would be 200 years, it takes some traction. And by the time you get to 1900, this idea of Zionism was in place that never will be reversed. And that's part of our study as we move forward. Now, part of our study after the French Revolution was we talk about the emancipation of the Jews. In other words, they are emancipated in the sense that they become common citizens and ordinary citizens in society rather than the underclass or like the slaves in our country or any country there were. So I have a little cartoon on the right or the left. It says the little German statement on the side. There's actually the court, the appeals court. The appeal court now allows the Jews into society. And notice in the back corner where the lady of justice hands holds up the bells of justice and allows Jews into that environment. So it's a picture of that day beginning of the Jewish emancipation really was at the French Enlightenment, and then it spread through Europe. So the pogroms have been devastating to the Jewish people. In scriptural language, their life or their lives have been hanging in doubt. By all estimations, they should have disappeared to the chagrin of some. They haven't. The Enlightenment in Paris, France, ended in a revolution in 1789, which brought humanism to the surface. And in that particular revolution, God was dispatched, different than our independence in America, which was a few years earlier. God was retained. With the dawning of the new human age, free of religion, it was time to cast off the prejudices against the Jews. It seemed like humanity ought to get along. We've now turned a new leaf. We're going to get rid of religion. We have God gone. And that's what's been corrupting society all along. And now that they're gone, we can really have humanity all agreeable, and we'll just, you know, be good about this. And the Jews ought to be and have the same place at the table as everybody else. So the Enlightenment brought that freedom to the Jews. We call it the Emancipation. Now, with the dawning of the new human age, free of religion, it was time to cast off the prejudice against the Jews, which Christian religion had brought on them. And anything to do with Christians, we've got to get rid of. If they're prejudiced against the Jews, well, then we've got to get rid of that prejudice. Now, the liberated Jews. For many Jews, the French atheistic revolution was the panacea they had been waiting for. At last, they were counted among the normal people of the world and can shed the burden of God that they felt as the chosen people. Classification one. Classification number two. But some understood their Jewishness deeper and understood from history that the wind can change in a moment of time, are cautious, and are pessimistic. Then we have number three. The Orthodox, who tenaciously hung onto their chosenness, resisted any assimilation or emancipation. So we have those three groups that basically exist today. These two descriptions of the Jewish community continue. Since the establishment of the nation in 1948, subdivision of the third category, the Orthodox, or the more Jewish Jews, can be the mildly observant Jews who have a strong national loyalty, and they're the ones that make their aliyah, which is the return to the land, leaving Orthodox Jews opposing Aliyah because the Messiah has not come. So even that bottom, most religious section, even is divided. And those that are religious, kind of, want to go back to the land, and the Orthodox Jews that wear the black hats are not all that happy about it at all because they're not coming back because the Messiah is there. So they oppose it. So the French Enlightenment, a little step back here, started the idea of Jewish or European emancipation. These ideas moved through Europe in the 19th century. We see the map here, bigger. And we see up there in Britain, it says that in 1832, they were allowed to be members of Parliament. And we have Benjamin Disraeli is a Jew, baptized a Christian, but he is Jewish blood, sympathetic to the Jew, because his dad had a fight with the rabbi. And so rather than submit to the rabbi, he had his son baptized Christian, and so he grew up as a Christian, and therefore probably allowed him to be a prime minister. But he was very sympathetic to the Jews. So we have really, I'm going to mention him later, he is the first one that really becomes officially from England, an international office to start thinking about Jewish homeland. And we have these numbers are all in the 1800s that recognized Jews and gave them emancipation, except Spain, 1919. They still had not given emancipation to the Jews. Now, by 1919, the only country that did, sounds like an echo, by 1919, the only country that did not grant emancipation to the Jews was Spain. The Almoraba degree, however you say that word, from 1492, and then when they were kicked out of Spain and put into Portugal. They had expelled the Jews from Spain, was formally rescinded December 16, 1968. Certainly in my lifetime, and in the lifetime of you, many of you. Since then, synagogues were opened and the communities were able to hold discrete activities. Now, in the United States, it's not been that way. The United States has always allowed Jews. The first Jew that came to the United States apparently was in 1570, and they have been here without restriction. I was reading somewhere, trying to find somewhere, where there was some early restriction in some of the colonies or one of the colonies. I could not find that, so I may not be right about that. But as a nation, there has never been any restriction on Jewish immigration other than any restriction on anybody by numbers or whatever, but they weren't held out because of their by classification. In 2012, between 5.5 and 8 million, I always thought it was around 7, Jews lived in the United States, and most of them lived in New York. And that's not a joke, it's true. A lot of them live in other big cities. But now it seems like the scales have tipped, and there are now more in England or in Israel than there are in the United States. Now, the United States has always been a place where Jews came. In fact, Emma Lazarus wrote that little poem, "Give me the tired, you're poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." And that's posted on the Statue of Liberty, one from her Colossus poem. So if you look at it from a big point of view, the United States has been a haven for the Jews, in a sense, without even trying. You know, there was no decided effort to say, well, now we're going to be open to the Jews. They just were. And it's one of those things that you look back and you know that God is in charge and he does some of these things without us asking us, in other words. And we also notice this. So now we have these Jews. You know, we think that this whole idea of Jews having a national homeland, that would be everybody would be out in the street dancing and whirling and, you know, like they can do. It wasn't the case. There were a lot of opposition to this idea. So we have those that were for emancipation. There was severe resistance to any effort toward establishing a Jewish state. Probably more resistant, obviously more resistance than support. The Jews were being assimilated, after all, for 100 years or 50 years. And things were going well for some of the Jews. The emancipation occurred in Europe. They were able to function quite freely. They were gaining in wealth and status and position. Who would want to upset the new order with the threat of new pogroms, which were sure to come if they stood out again? So assimilate or die, the question became rather be a normal citizens of the country. For those that wanted to continue to be subjugated, the underclass, the prospect of continuing as a separatist Jew was daunting, yet there were some with the lofty desire to be faithful to their perceived calling. These fought anticipation and assimilation, but not fully understanding nor having false hopes built up. They opposed the idea of a Jewish state. And I just put these up. I started this and I got stuck because I had some more information about this, but I wasn't sure I could verify it. So I just have this idea that there are from very, very far out Jews that are atheistic or agnostic. And some of the people that are pictured here, we have Einstein. I'm not sure he was agnostic. He sometimes would talk about God acknowledging him, but he is usually listed as agnostic or atheist. Of course, Woody Allen, that's not a problem. Zuckerman, who did Facebook, so you may want to cancel your subscription. You have Freud. You have other people. I don't know who they are. We have down the bottom, Ayn Rand. We have, what's the name, Bill Maher. Carl Sagan, no doubt, no question about that or no surprise about that. So we have these secular Jews that really don't want to have anything with the Jewishness. I call it the burden of God. They would just like to unload it and just to be normal people. But that's not going to happen, obviously. So with this kind of a mix, we want to look at the catalyst of Zionism. What stirred the pot? In this milieu of all these back and forth questions, you know, the Jews can argue vehemently. There's probably been jokes about that, how they can argue and they think they're going to kill each other and they walk off as friends. So in this big argument, the Lord, capital L-O-R-D, means Jehovah of Israel, begins to link an unbreakable chain of unpredictable events together. They just happen. Well, we start out with the pogroms in 1881 in Russia. Remember, it said two things, the date and the place was Russia, or Middle Russia, Middle East, Middle Europe, where Prussia is, and to Poland. Was those Was that program worse than any other? Well, I don't know, but it was horrible, and it went on for years. And even if it was horrible, it was just not that in itself, although yet it was, but it was mostly the nature of the time. It just somehow, it, you know what a catalyst is, the thing has to be just right before you do one thing and then it blows up. So it was just that, because you can't say, well, that was the worst of all the programs. Well, maybe, maybe not. It didn't seem like necessarily true, but it was a factor, one factor. The Jews were accused of killing the Tsar, started this. Tsar Alexander, remember, told you about the Church of the Spilt Blood in St. Petersburg. Very, very beautiful church that's been rebuilt, and the mosaics are absolutely incredible. It's worth a trip just to see the church. You don't want to convert, though, in this Russian Orthodox. No, I don't want to go there, but it's a beautiful church. All right, his son, Alexander III, likely knowing the Jews had no part in it, nonetheless, because he was mad, blamed them. Now, blame somebody, kind of like Nero, so blame the Jews. And, of course, that sticks. People don't like Jews, so blame the Jews. And the programs went on for years. Others were stirring. Hess, about 1850s. He was in Damascus. There wasn't a Damascus affair. Now, that's a different word than we think about today. It was an event that happened. It was a Jewish blood libel where they're accused of killing Gentiles, sometimes their kids, children, to be used in their sacrificial ritual. All of it is made up. But there were 8 Jews that were accused of it, killing a monk, and the dread of an ongoing violence that will not disappear with the progress of humanity, of the Enlightenment. You know, he didn't believe it's going to happen. He didn't think it was going to go on. He figured these programs are going to continue on no matter what. So fear spread, a black shadow on every community from New York to Odessa. Then it dawned upon me that as Hess, for the first time in the midst of my socialistic activities, we'll talk sometime soon about the socialist ideas of the Jews, that I belonged to my underclass, to my unfortunate, slandered, despised, dispersed people, and I wanted to express my Jewish patriotic sentiment in a cry of anguish. So he writes. So these are just things that really don't go anywhere, but they're out there happening, and people do read. And he says, he was not content with the anguish. He wanted a solution. There was only one. Without a country, you are a bastard of humanity. Mazzini's yet unwritten dictum was already inescapable. Emancipation was emptiness. Now, I've mentioned Benjamin Disraeli already. He was a parliament member in 1858-59, Jewish, but raised as Christian, but very high Jewish sympathies, novelist, essayist. And I have read someplace kind of weird, so I don't know about him too much, but except that he was there and he was influential. Now, last week we talked about Leo Pinsker a little bit. He wrote some pamphlets, and it was the pamphlets was called Loving Israel, the Lover of Israel. So he was a physician, and he wrote this because there were programs in Odessa, in the area where he was practicing as a physician, northeast of Odessa. So he was, first of all, going to be on the assimilation side, but he changed his mind and took the idea that there has to be another solution. And so in a way, well, although he wasn't related to or knew about more theater, Herzl knew about him, it was that information was out there. People were reading it. So he got the people ready. All right, so we had those individuals just sort of out there stirring the water or preparing the way. Now, the next poking at Jewish sensitivities involved one insignificant... I'm going to pick up my hanky. All right, the next poking at Jewish sensitivities involved one insignificant Jew in France. It was a treatment of one Alfred Dreyfus, a general in the French army. A poke was felt by Theodor Herzl of Budapest. He was born there, lived there. In 1894, Alfred Dreyfus, a disliked Jew, was accused by his fellow officers in the French army of selling spy secrets to the Germans. Not a good idea. He was tried and convicted of treason based on a secret file that no one but the prosecution could see. Now, we have rules of discovery. You know, you can't do that anymore. Everybody has to look at everybody else's stuff. But they hid it from him. They probably hid on the basis that, well, this is, what's the word these days? Secret stuff. Classified. There, thank you, B. This is a classified information. We can't show it. Well, under that basis, they got a prosecution. The prosecution got a conviction. So his sentence was life in prison. And we see a picture there stripping him of his buttons. And I guess like boys do, they stamp on him, you know, to really show that he was disgraced in front of the building where he was convicted. All right, so we have that issue. Now, he is not the issue. The issue is Theodore Herzl. In fact, we could spend a couple of days, a couple of our lessons on Herzl. He is an amazing person. You will not forget Theodore Herzl, because I'll say it enough. He is buried in Jerusalem, and they moved his body there. So in other words, he's a highly thought of person, probably the most highly thought of person in the modern day Israel. Some would say even of all time. I don't know if they want to compare him with Moses, but some of the Jews might. You know, he's very, very highly thought of now. All right, so he lived from 1860 to 1904. You see, that's 44 years. He lived to be a short life, lived relatively, and died a young man. Now, Herzl, an Austro-Hungarian Jew, journalist, playwright from Budapest, was assigned to Paris as a correspondent for the New Free Press, a Paris newspaper. While there, he was to cover the Dreyfus trial in 1896. At first, he thought Dreyfus guilty of the charges against him, but as the trial continued, he had a change of mind and began to believe in Dreyfus's innocence. Is it Dreyfus or Dreyfus, however you'd say his name? In the ordinary course of his duties as a correspondent, he witnessed the degradation of Captain Alfred Dreyfus of the French General Staff, who had been sentenced on a cooked-up charge of high treason and exiled to a living death on Devil's Island solely because he was a Jew. That such a thing could happen in France, where the revolution occurred, where the Jews were emancipated less than 100 years ago, about 100 years ago, was a problem for him. How were the civic rights of the Jews ever going to come about? So it was frightful enough in itself. But that the trial could have made all France, from the highest circles to the lowest, see that with anti-Semitism made him take stock of the whole Jewish situation. The Jewish problem was still unresolved 100 years later after emancipation. All Herzl's manhood was up in arms. A solution must be found. He must find it. He had it. So what did he say? A Jewish state is the solution. The Jews, a nation among the nations, with a country of its own. Now that's what he came to after watching the miscarriage of justice. So our pivotal personality does not stand on the shoulders of any predecessor, nor come out of any Jewish organization. Theodore Herzl was a lone wolf, a one-man army, committed with all his energy, capital, including his family, finances, and health, to a self-appointed mission to find a homeland for the Jews where they would be safe. He was a leader without parallel, banished no former Jewish connections, a man set on a divine course, yet not an observant Jew. He seldom, if ever, attended the synagogue until 1897 at the Zionist Conference. He was a secular progressive in our terms today. So after this trial, he wrote a book called Judenstaat. In his book in 1896, written by Theodor Herzl, was first published in 1896 in Leipzig and then Vienna. It is subtitled with Proposal of a Modern Solution for the Jewish Question, and originally called the Address to the Rothschilds, referring to the Rothschilds family's banking dynasty. Now, I don't know if you know this, but the Rothschilds were on an international banking family, and we'll meet them later again. But for now, since the Rothschilds family was Jewish, it is reasonable, he thought, that they could assist in the new state effort, thus the address. Now, since the idea of a convention to instill interest in a Jewish state was Herzl's alone, it fell to him to organize it to the last detail, worked himself silly. He insists on full formal dress by the men and the women that came to this event, and in all events after they were fully dressed, black, white, ladies dressed up. After all, they were doing important work. Many of the Jewish friends opposed the idea. Some did not want to begin and be disappointed, so it fell to Herzl to arrange the details amid much opposition, even close friends. It was to be held in Munich, Germany, but due to the opposition of the Orthodox Reformed Jews, who opposed the idea, he moved it to Basel, Switzerland, where there was more agreement by the Jews. So we have pictures of the conference. Not all, of course, not all of them opposed it. Obviously, some showed up. They said around 200, but I look on the right. No, it's my next picture here. It seems like if you that thing circles clear around, there would have been more than 200 people there. But there, the Jewish website said probably around 200 people. I would have guessed more like 400. But maybe I'm counting the observers, and there were observers there. So maybe the 200 are just the delegates. And he had one friend there, David Wolfschon, suggested a flag for the nation. We'll see that in a minute. So the Wurz conference were there. And there was an observer there of significance, and I forget who he was, an English person, and I could not remember. I will remember it later, and I'll tell you who it was of significance that was at this conference. Okay, now, Theodor Herzl's work was responsible for the movement that would eventually establish the Jewish state. That's why he's so important. He expected that it would be in his lifetime, for sure, in 50 years. And if you take the ads, you're at 51 years when it occurred. Now, this flag by his friend David Wolfschon suggested the national flag blue and white in the color of our prayer shawls, he said, and the seven-starred flag. So there you have it, and you see the way it turned out. I thought they were ambitious. Right away, we've got a flag. I think that's optimism. So at this Zionist conference, there were 16 countries represented, mostly poor people, many whose passages were paid by Herzl. And I was talking to my wife about this, and these transportation issues really are, you know, a non-issue for us. But in the Versailles conference in 1919 after World War I, there were some that had come from Central Europe to go to the conference, walked. And it took them so long to walk that the conference was over before they got there, and they didn't get their, you know, choice or their request in. I mean, to think that you walk across Europe, well, you probably walked, rode a wagon, rode a horse. Some places they had trains. So when these people come from all over Europe, and a lot of them are poor, this is quite an event. All right, so as I said, they were already dressed in formal wear. 26 newspapers had correspondents, other luminaries were present. Chaim Weizmann, later a president, was there. And the resolution was hammered out with a lot of argument. When the Jews are together, there's going to be an argument. But this is what they came up with. These are the first phrase in this argument or the statement was, Zionism aims to establish for the Jewish people a legally assured home in Palestine. And then over the years we have, these are the presidents, with Herzl, Wolfschon, this Wartburg, Weizmann, Sokol, and Weizmann again, Ben-Gurion, we know that name, and these other ones who might be are not familiar with. So this was a continuing line of leaders in this organization. I watched the movie. I would recommend it highly. It's called It Is No Dream. It's a new one, 2012. It's about Herzl. It's his life. And I tell you, it gripped me because I thought how this man has been used to do this work. And he's not a believer. And he dies at a young age. And I'm thinking, you know, the Lord, how is he going to bless this man for what he did? He doesn't believe in the Messiah. So, he's got to be lost and going to hell. I said, how can this be? I wasn't shaken, but I just thought about that a lot. How can these people that do this work that God intends them to do, and yet they are not really believers? And we say, well, that's how God works. So about him, this is off the blurb on the movie. Over the span of 8 years, Herzl organized and led a nationwide political movement that within 50 years led to the establishment of the State of Israel. The film follows Herzl as he meets with kings, prime ministers, ambassadors, the Sultan, the Pope, the government ministries, Constantinople to St. Petersburg, from Paris to Berlin, from Vienna to Vilna in his quest to build a Jewish nation. Now remember, the time he didn't fly there, I don't know how he did it. By that time, Herzl was dead at age 44. He was a personal tale of exceptional pathos, passion. His heroic efforts over 10 crowded years destroyed his body. They killed his marriage, too. His family legacy was pitiful. His wife, Julia, survived him only 3 years. His daughter, Pauline, became a heroin addict and died in 1930. Of an overdose. His son, Hans, under treatment by Freud, committed suicide. What a testimony. A little later, while other daughter, Trudy, was starved to death in the Nazi camp, and his son, Stefan, too, killed himself in 1946, wiping out the family. I mean, it's a tragedy. And yet God used this man in a mighty way. Incredible. So yet Zionism was his protege. Or prodigy. So we had conferences that went on every year from then on. As years passed, suitable space for the Jews was elusive. All their diplomatic efforts failed to soften the Turkish resistance to Jewish immigration. We'll talk about the Turks a little bit here. Remember, they're over the land. Soften the Turkish resistance to Jewish immigration to the Levant. That's the strip of land we're talking about. Before World War I, the Germans first supported the exodus, but the Kaiser was courting the Turks. Thus, no help to pressure the declining Ottoman Empire to accept the Jews. Anything, but not the Jews. Many places have been suggested. Madagascar, El Rish, which is between the Gaza Strip and Egypt right now, where there's a spring. Argentina, finally, the British offered Uganda, which was under their protectorate at that time. Herzl was agreeable to this British proposal, but the Congress rejected even as a temporary settlement to move to Israel later, not even going to get to Uganda. But many of the delegates saw it as a betrayal of Zionism. The Russians walked out. Herzl concluded, Palestine is the only land where our people can come to rest. And he was right. So Herzl was disappointed. In fact, Herzl was so alarmed by the new and far more bloody pogroms now taking place in 1902 in Russia, they would have settled for Uganda. Even the Russian Jews, who are going to face these pogroms, rejected anything but the land. So the Russian pogroms continued. Now we have something that's really interesting. I never knew this before until I got to study this. We have the British Landau, Secretary of Foreign Affairs, produced a letter at this time. If a site can be found which the Jewish Colonial Trust and His Majesty Commissioner consider suitable and which commends itself to His Majesty's government, Lord Lansdowne will be prepared to entertain favorable proposals for the establishment of a Jewish colony or settlement on conditions which will enable the members to observe their national customs. Now, that's a big thing. What this is, remember, Israel has no national standing. This is like you walk into the White House and say, give me a piece of land. Well, who are you? So until you have some national recognition by another nation, you have no standing. So this gives the Jews a standing. The British looked out and said, the Jews have reason to have their own land. We're going to stand and help them do that. That's what's interesting here. I've never heard that before. I don't know how it's used. I don't know how it was used later on with the Balfour, but we have already Britain on the side of trying to establish a homeland for the Jews. Now, I said before about those that oppose nationhood, close friend, Nordau. Well, I don't know if you call him a friend or not, but it certainly was an enemy. And they argued strongly against this. I'm trying to hurry because, again, I'm off a little short on time. So we have kind of summarization up to now. We have pro-state influences by Disraeli, Hess, Pinsker, and others. We have the pogroms in Russia that set the set the stage. We have the Dreyfus trial in Paris, and now we have Herzl. He is the guy that makes it happen. The Zionist Conference, 1897. Diplomacy had not generated a release of the land. They had no national standing as a nation. That's where they were. And they had this one super big obstacle called the Ottoman Empire. And he had been there talking to them more than once. The Zionists had one major blockage. It was the path to statehood. The blockage was not the present occupants of the land as such, although they might have had an opinion or two, but those who politically held the keys to the immigration gates. Herzl had a number of occasions attempted to meet with the Turkish Sultan, and when he went there, he wouldn't see him, but the Sultan did give him a present. He took that as a good sign. At last, in 1902, in exchange for the debt of the Turks, I'll explain this in a minute, it was proposed that the Jews could have access to the land, but the Sultan refused. Turks were terribly in debt. And Herzl walks in, talk about this a minute, Herzl walks in with the idea they'll pay your debts. The Sultan said no. So Herzl attempted to use Jewish influence, German influence, to influence the Turks, but it failed when the Kaiser Wilhelm was favorable, and then when he met with him in Palestine with Herzl, he turned Herzl down, turned cool to the idea. Well, obviously he was courting the favor of the Turks. Why, I'm not sure. But the blockage was only of a dying Turkish empire. Why? So Islam followers claim, via Ishmael, talk a little bit about who these Turkish people are. They're not Arabs, they're Turks. Islam followers claim, via Ishmael and all, to be the legitimate descendants of Abraham, Ishmael being the eldest son. However, that claim was never made until 2,500 years later, in the 6th century AD, by Muhammad. Muhammad never wrote a word, so it was left to those who heard him teach and repeat revelations to assemble his words into the Quran. The words noted were uttered over a period of 23 years. Key to understand the Quran, you need to know this when you listen to the news, the key to understand is a conflicting message in the Quran. Some say it's a peaceful book, some say it's a violent book. Well, the reason is it's both. The key is to understand the Quran is that his attitude changed from being conciliatory to the Jews and the Christians in the days he expected widespread acceptance of his ideas, but changed to advocating lethal force on anyone who denied his claim to be the prophet. So at first, he was peaceful. End of his writing, he was very militant. So Islam in 750 shows in the middle panel, well, you don't see that one, the three colors. It's extensive, 150 years. And remember, they had a walk. the scope of Islam, how it spread. Now, we aren't interested in all of Islam. We're only interested in the Turkish Empire, which is called the Ottoman Empire. In this case, we see the red. And it's huge. It's huge. Only the yellow ochre part of the empire was left at the time of World War I. It was bankrupt in 1879 due to a war, I think, with Russia, is now on life support. Levant was part of the Ottoman Empire. The Arabs wanted to be free of the Turks, but the Turks continued to grasp onto it. And we'll talk more about that later. This is where Lawrence of Arabia comes in because he defends the Arabs having their own land against the Turks. The Ottoman Empire begins with the demise of the last vestiges of the Roman or the Byzantine Empire, the Christian Empire. The last vestige of the Roman Empire was 1453 in Constantinople when it fell to the Islam. Now, this new Islamic state grew to its zenith under Suleiman the Great, again, very, very rapidly in the 17th century. It stretched from the Persian Gulf to Egypt to the Caucasus, in the north to Morocco in the west. You basically see all the colored, darker colored area. That's all become Islam in just a few years under Suleiman the Great. Now, maybe about the Ottoman Empire or Islam, it may be an oversimplification or a simplified observation. Islam can flourish only when there are unconquered territories to be conquered where established wealth is already present. It is a matter of slow national death as the wealth is consumed in these conquered spaces and not replaced. Islam does not have a God that is consequential enough to draw out the productive aspects of its subjects. It can multiply the people but cannot subdue the earth, according to the Genesis mandate. It can rape the landscape but does not know how to plant a tree. We'll talk about this later, because that is the condition in which Israel receives the land. Now, the philosophy of Ottomans, or the Islam, the philosophy is, if Allah wills it, then we'll do it. This is an excuse not to be productive. What can be achieved are the bare necessities of life, even if that, but it can produce large families that it cannot feed. Later, we see the condition of the land after the Ottoman rule of 500 years. The Bible describes its condition in very graphic detail, the land of jackals. So from its zenith, the Ottoman Empire began to die a slow death since it could not sustain itself. It became known as the sick man of Europe. They defrauded on their loans in 1879. Debt was $161 million, as far as I can tell, which is a little bit less than $1 billion in our treasury or in our currency. And so we have all these cartoons about the sick man of Europe, and here we have one being fed by the neighbors trying to keep him alive. Remember, he was dying, and Herzl walks in and suggests that we can take care of your debt, and he turned down, and he could, whatever. So when Herzl assumed Turkish debt, the Sultan on life support refuses the bailout. Of course, Herzl can be criticized by the pro-Muslims for trying to take advantage of Turkey. That's called negotiations. But Turkey did not have a possibility to continue. How could you turn down something like that? However, due to the anti-Semitism, turned down what could have been a legitimate offer. After all, the international banking family, the Rothschilds, may have been able to pay off their indebtedness and keep Turkey. But it was not to be, and God used World War I to remove the Ottomans, gave Turkey to the people, and freed the land of the Levant, and gave them a mandate over to the British. So again, we have this last link in the bottom here. I'm going to rush through here. The last link is the changed land trustee. And that's what we're going to get into next week with the event of World War I. In late June 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria was assassinated by a Serbian nationalist in Sarajevo, Bosnia. An escalation of threats and mobilization orders followed the incident, leading by mid-August to the outbreak of World War I, which pitted Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire, the so-called Central Powers, against the Great Britain, France, Russia, and Italy, and Japan. Don't worry about all those nations. Now, I'm saying that we had an offer that could have been good for everybody. It was turned down. What happened next? War. How bad was World War I? I'll just give you a little bit and talk more about next week. Removing the Turks from the land holders. It took World War I and the death of 150 million by some count. Death of 150 million people. And we have the total number of men mobilized, 65 million, 57% of those involved in war died. Total number of killed in World War I, 8.5 million. The number of casualties in World War I, 37 million. Those missing in action, they must be dead, another 7.7 million. Those wounded, 19 million. World War I was Act One, and World War II was the second act, which together represent the outcome of the ideas of men. In the process of restoring the Jews to their land, there has been unimaginable bloodshed over the question of the land, and the conflict still has not claimed its last victim. What better outcome for all if the Turks had taken the offer Herzl had offered, and the Jews had offered, and the Jews could be into the land even if they got it for nothing? Instead, the Turks died at the rate of 1 out of 4. 5 million deaths, 25% of their population. They paid dearly for their negative word. All right, so that just introduces World War I, because World War I becomes a game changer for the entire world, really, because, as I said, World War I really wasn't finished till World War II was finished, and we'll talk about that. But we see in the hand of God is preparing things that could have been easy, but since it was done easy, it becomes hard. Isn't that kind of how it is often when people are disobedient to him? All right, I'll be up here after your class, and have questions, ask me then. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the evening together again, for the work of your Spirit to work mightily in your people. We've read in the scriptures that they will be back in the land. They will be there blessed by your Spirit. They will be back in the land as believers. And what we see now is just the foreshadowing of some of these events. Lord, our heart goes out to our Jewish friends that aren't believers. We pray for their salvation as we have opportunity to witness to them. Lord, they face a tremendous difficulty in the years ahead. We're sure of that from the scripture. And above all, Lord, they will face the surety of eternal hell, punishment and the damnation of hell. And Lord, we just pray that we have friends that are Jewish that we can explain this to them, and may they be open. Thank you, Lord, for the way you work in history and for the opportunity we have to be together in these weeks to analyze and look at it. And above all, as we get a better picture of the whole thing and see your hand working, and these links are linked together, bringing us to the conclusion they will have their own land back, and just as you've said so many, many years ago. Thank you for bringing us out tonight, for the rain, and keep us safe as we go home. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.